Hi there, and welcome to the Proud to Be of Rust and Glass podcast. Sandra Rivers-Gill, Toledo area poet and performing artist, is here with us today to talk about, you guessed it, poetry and performing art. Sandra, it's so great to have you on the show. You've been a longtime supporter of everything we're trying to do to support the Northwest Ohio art and literary scene. We're absolutely thrilled to have an opportunity to get to know you a little bit better today. Thanks for sharing your creative journey with us and taking the time to chat today.
Thank you so much.
So we'll just start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me today. I really appreciate it. Thank you for allowing me to share my art with you. I am born and raised in Toledo, so I'm a Toledoan. I am a wife, a mother, a daughter, a grandmother, and a really good friend. So I also am retired from the University of Toledo Medical Center, formerly the MCO. And I like to think that I love the idea of being creative. You know, I've always been creative as far back as I can remember. Like to think that, you know, I was creative in a certain way. So I was really been blessed to have been having these opportunities and have a broad experience and have a lot of aha moments. And I remember that way before I even retired, I said, well, when I retire, I just want to do all things creative. And that's exactly what I'm doing. So I'm really grateful, you know, to have those opportunities.
I love it. I love to see it. I love to hear it. You, as far as I have seen, your creativity comes in many different forms. You do poetry, you do performing arts. Do you want to touch base a little bit on those things that you're doing?
Sure. Let me give you a little precursor as to the art form itself. So if I could define it as a metaphor, I would say that my art form, as far as the writing portion of it is a fusion of rhythm and blues, gospel and soul, and jazz tapping at the heart rock of believing. So when I say that, I'm saying that my work generally has musicality to it, has timbre and rhythm to it, you know, has sound and also a beat to it. It has tempo. And what I'm also trying to say here is that it is not put into a certain box. I have a certain sound, and I believe that it's, it's a little different from others, and difference is good, you know.
It absolutely is, yeah. Did you always have this sort of rhythmic, musical performance undertone in your writing, or is that something that you've developed over time?
It's something that's probably developed over time, although when I look at some of my earlier writing, it had a little bit in it, but I didn't recognize it until here lately. Somebody had mentioned it to me, you have a lot of musicality in your voice
when you saw it, you said, hey,
things
me.
Like that, and that's great. And the thing about that, my background is we grew up with music, you know, in the house. We had gospel, we had soul, we had blues, we had everything. We had not that we had hip hop back then, but we did have R&B and everything. So I grew up with show tunes, and my mom sang; she was a mezzo soprano, and so we just grew up with that music in the house, and so I'm realizing now that I'm incorporating that particular background into, you know, what I write.
That's awesome. So, it was very much a part of you, and it continues to be today. Who were some of your favorite artists growing up?
Oh, wow. I had a diversity of everybody. Of course, R&B. I mean, not any particular. Let me think. Hall & Oates, Temptations. Believe it or not, John Denver. We sang some of his songs, you know. And we just grew up just embracing all forms of music. Elton John is another one. And so whatever song played on the radio, if it had a good beat to it, a good vibe, and a good message to it, we sang to it, we danced to it and everything. And so we just learned to embrace it all, you know.
It's always a little tragic to me when I talk to somebody about their music and they love one specific genre and they don't realize the broad, you know, amazing spectrum of musicians that are out there and what you can take from each of them and all that stuff. So regarding your poetry, I think you have a chapbook that will be on its way or here.
It is here.
What went into that? Are there any themes in that? Is there anything that you were thinking of before you started writing it?
Okay. Well, the chapbook is called As We Cover Ourselves With Light, And I had written variations of that collection, like years in the making. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to write a chapbook. And so with this particular chapbook, I assembled quite a few poems. And some weren't always theme-based, and I didn't really know that going into it. And so, you know, there were, you know, some rejections along the way, but that's par for the course. Right. And so here recently, a few years ago, I repackaged the poems, and I thought, why not talk about family? Why not celebrate family and honor the relationships in my family, my mother, my father, my grandparents, and, you know, and package it up into a book. And that's exactly what I did. So a few years ago, I began just sending the manuscript out initially to contests and things like that. Mm-hmm. So some hit and misses, you know. And then finally, I had a publisher acknowledge the fact that, yeah, I love this poem, these poems in this book. I love this manuscript, and I would love to publish it. And so that's what happened. And so the book is published by Shilanajik Editions, and Haley Mitchell-Hagen is the publisher.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think a lot of people don't realize the work that goes into it and the rejections and the things like that. Mm-hmm. Was there anything along the way that really surprised you in putting together a complete project like this?
I learned a lot about myself, and I know that anything worth doing is worth doing well and putting in the sweat equity to get it done, and that's what I found myself doing it. I've always written, so I've always tried to put that work into it. The revisions are somewhat challenging sometimes, but you have to do it in order to have the work smooth and have it appreciated by others who read it. So let's see, that was one thing. Another challenge, not so much a challenge, I mean, I love writing, but another challenge, in quotes, is when the book was accepted, I had a collection of 21 poems. And so I was asked to boost it up to 40 more. So I had to write
almost
another 19 poems, right? And so she said, well, do you have poems for that? And I said, oh, yes, I do. Of course I do. Of course I do. So a lot of poems were brewing in the back of my head. And I brought those to fruition. And so I created pretty much out of the 19, half of them were brand new. And the other ones were like ideas that I brought, you know, and I put that together and, you know, in such of a format. I don't know, the way I planned it out, I just started with one particular poem and went on to the end. And so they all sort of vibe together, you know, in that collection. So, yep, they were accepted. That's, you know, just like that. So I
congratulations
really appreciate
to that.
It. Thank
you so much. I'm impressed that you were able to get almost double it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, sometimes you get put under fire for that. And that sort of gets the juices flowing and you don't have a choice, really.
Yeah.
You gotta get it done.
And it only took maybe 2 months to get them all together. Another surprise is that sometimes when you send poems out and they're rejected for one reason or another, not that they're bad poems or anything like that, sometimes it's a title. And I realized that I had to change. I looked through the collection again and I changed several titles before I sent them out again and they were accepted just like that. So that makes a difference as
well.
Yeah,
you never know when you're submitting what's getting it rejected or what they're not vibing with.
Yeah.
It sounds like the collection, you said it was a lot about family. It sounds like it's a very personal collection. How did you take getting those rejections with pieces that were so close to you as a person, and how did you not take those personally?
Well, I didn't take them personally. I felt like they were good poems and they stood on their own. It's just that some publishers are looking for a certain thing, or maybe they've received something similar to it, or maybe they're just looking for, maybe it wasn't quite what they were looking for at the time. So I don't take that personally anymore. I used to because that's my baby and I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, if I love it, you have to love it too, you know, but that's not always the case, you know, and for whatever reason they reject it. And so I dust them off and I will send them out to the next publisher and it is accepted. And if that doesn't work, I'll keep sending them out until they are.
It always stings a little bit, but it starts to sting a little bit less.
I know. And then sometimes you get the email and you just know, oh, there's something coming in, you know, and you had sent something out. And so, It's like, okay, should I open it?
It's a little nerve-wracking.
Do I want
to
open it?
Got to build yourself up to
just open it. Just open it. It's like, ah, and you get the standard rejection letter. A nice one, you know, but, you know, it's what it is. Yeah. It's just what it is in this industry.
It is. It is, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if you want to write, it's something that you kind of have to learn how to deal with, unfortunately. Right. But it also shows that you're doing things and that you're actively submitting, and that's more than what a lot of people are doing. So
I try to submit a few poems a month, and I never stop working. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, I'm creating something and there might be a deadline coming up, so I'm writing toward the deadline as well. Mm-hmm. So I keep a chart, kind of like a spreadsheet. And you might have that same situation where you have a spreadsheet and you have a deadline, and you have the publisher and what they're wanting and what you're sending and things like that. So it's just so I can keep track of all the things that go out and what's accepted and what's not.
Right. Now, are you writing to specific publications, or are you writing for yourself and finding places where they fit?
I'm finding places for where they fit. You know, there are a lot of journals out there that I like with what I read. And so I think that, you know, my poetry might be a good fit for them.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Before we shift into some of your other sort of creative endeavors, I know you have many others that I want to dive into a little bit. Did you want to share a couple of your poems with us?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. All right. So this poem is called Danju, and it's for George Floyd. Hmm. I had forgotten its coolness I carry from icebox to counter slab. The pear's taste is a hot commodity, crisp and sweet. Its body bears a certified label, the inspector's choice. Its unbroken skin sits silent on my countertop. The greenish gold of a silhouette does not wobble or collapse like a cracked egg. Funny how present tense can worm its way into a memory. When I was a young girl, the white woman next door grew pear trees, littered the ground with their fruit. I had forgotten. By summer's end, she donned a straw hat, climbed the ladder of her constellation of crops, shared them with my brother and me. The pears sat in our kitchen windowsill, our noses pressed against the scent till they were ripe enough. Now I stand in my kitchen counter, paring the skin from its flesh. Its fresh tears stream in my hands. I had forgotten pears ripen at room temperature in their cultural climate. I remember the instructions that guarantee a pear's ripeness. Simply press its neck.
I don't know if you can hear this podcast, but that was a good snap for that beautiful poem.
So that poem was a combination of a memory, you know, when I was a child and the lady next door did have pear trees. Mm-hmm. But at the time that I wrote it, I was writing in a creative writing class at University of Toledo in my doctorate program. And we were supposed to write about two objects, or one object, a metaphor, actually, object and something real, and combine the two. And so that's what that poem came out of. And when I wrote the poem, what had happened was the George Floyd murder had taken place the prior year, and I started writing about this poem. And something about me personally not knowing when a pear was ripe, I had to look it up. And this particular poem, this particular pear, the danju, the way it's shaped, you actually press the neck around the stem, and that's how you can tell that a pear was ripe. And so I thought that was so revealing in the way that George Floyd had died as well. Mm-hmm. So it was just really very, I don't know, visceral to me. Yeah.
There's a very stark, unexpected connection between those two things.
Mm-hmm. And so that's why the ending was so abrupt. So this next poem is a distant hymn. And what I like to do is play with homonyms. Mm. And so this hymn is H-Y-M-N as opposed to M-I-N. A distant hymn. He owns a pre-loved sedan, the shade of passive beige, not at all rebellious or disrespectful. The four of us push open a dream, a distant hymn to buckle into. Our journey is a shifting map. On Sundays, the car sits in the drive, stores up empty praises, fills a collection plate of dim memory. I have never heard a preacher's faux sermon given from the pulpit of a couch, nor mumbling words from keys he keeps in his pocket. The three of us march on, wearing the rain of broken umbrellas.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
So besides the incredible poetry that you write and that you just shared with us, you also write other things. You write plays, right?
Yes.
What is the difference for you as far as mindset and energy between poetry and plays?
Well, I think the energy level is the same for me. The only difference is when you write poetry, it's usually for the page. Mm-hmm. And when you perform on the stage, there's a little bit more energy, I think, that comes with the immediate feedback that you get from it. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily so from a book or from, mm-hmm. Reading on, just reading, basically. I like to say when you're performing, particularly spoken word poetry, no one sees you sweat. And then, I will write out my poem that I'm going to recite and memorize it. And it takes a lot of work to memorize that. And just be ready for it, be confident about it, and just be ready on stage just to perform it. And so I kind of tell myself, never look into the eyes of the audience, because you might get stuck there. You might in your mind think that somebody's criticizing you right there.
Might make eye contact with the wrong person.
But after a while, after I got really comfortable about being on stage, I had gotten so comfortable about it, I could come down off the stage, and this was like maybe at some smaller venues, and actually shake somebody's hand while I'm speaking. Mm-hmm. So I had gotten that comfortable about it, because in your head, I'm not looking at the paper in my head, mm-hmm. as much as I am flowing, with that information. So I like it. I love it. I love the feeling that I get back immediately, and I can see some nods. I can see people sitting there kind of stoic, not knowing, me not knowing what they're thinking, mm-hmm. but they're probably thinking about maybe something that resonates with them in this poem. And so I like the idea of actually performing and touching those in the audience who I don't even know what situation might resonate with them, And so in that way, I can make a difference to them. I like the idea of encouraging and motivating and just really uplifting people with what I have to say. And so that's poetry on stage.
Right.
And so there's playwriting also. I've done that for quite a few years. I just eased into it. I didn't have any formal training doing it at all. It's just something that just comes naturally to me. I started out writing plays in church, and we have a cast of anywhere from, five people all the way up to 30 people, and I would have a cadre of people helping me as a team. Other writers would come in. I would direct and produce and write as myself, and I think I've done, probably a number of plays, and we would do a couple plays a year. The first time I did it, I sort of volunteered because there was a need for someone to oversee the drama ministry at my church. And so I just sort of volunteered, and I said, hey, do you need something for Easter or whatnot? Yes, we do. We need somebody to kind of be over. It's like, okay, I just walked into something here. So I put a play together in about 4 weeks, and had advertised for the cast and a crew of people to come and to support it, and it was wonderful. And so that same year we did Christmas play, and I think it was called Signs Still Delivered or something. And and turned around 2 months later and had a Black History play. It was a full-on play. I think it was called Let the Church Say Amen.
Okay.
And with a lot of my poems, I bring the poetry over into the playwriting as well. Some spoken word and a little bit of hip hop and things like that. And that draws in the youth. It really draws and engages everybody because everybody can relate to it. And so most recently, I performed my first one-woman show. And that was a few years ago. And I did that, performed that at the at Bowling Green State University at their Black Issues Conference. Mm. And that was awesome. Again, I had to send a proposal. I've never done a proposal in my life before. I figured it out. At the time, I was taking a course with Tom Barton at the University of Toledo. It was I was studying Zora Neale Hurston. And there was an application process through Bowling Green. At that time, I was working part-time. And I applied for and put together this proposal. And I used Zora Neale Hurston as the character of which I was going to play.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
That had to feel really cool.
Yeah, exactly. So my professor was like, yeah, you know. And so the play is about, the title of the play was A Letter to Langston. And so it was a monologue. And very dramatically done, and I incorporated music and, again, poetry. So it's like this long spoken word poem, you know, but it was chopped up into different aspects of her life and the relationship between her and Langston Hughes. So that's something that I'm most proud of. I've always wanted to do a one-woman show, but I didn't know what the context of it was going to be. Right. And so that was my first one, and I'm looking forward to more in the future.
That sounds incredibly rewarding and empowering at
yes,
the same time.
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
And it does seem like a big difference between the poetry side of things and then the acting and the playwright side of things. Is there's a lot more collaboration.
Yeah.
And it's much less you in a spotlight as it is you working for and with other people.
Right, right. I had to direct myself.
Lots
and lots of practice. And so with the songs, I had to kind of get advice from my mom. Is like, okay, well, you know, am I doing the right run on this? I said, yeah, well, you make the song exactly the way it's supposed to be, and then you can do whatever you want to with it. And so that's what I did. So I took her advice, and it worked really well. And so in the audience, you know, after the play was over, which was probably a good 45 minutes, I think, you know, there was a question and answer period, and that was really enlightening.
To directly
really
engage
fun.
With people.
Exactly.
Make it really interactive.
It
I love it.
I love
to hear it. Do you have any advice for aspiring performers or poets?
Well, I would say stay the course. Keep your focus on your own voice. You know, we all have our own voices and sound. Grow where you're planted. Not many of us can uproot from Toledo and just go to New York and live or Florida or even L.A. So grow and make a difference where you plant it and enjoy the journey.
I think the closer you look, the more you realize that you can make your dreams happen right here at home. And like you said, you don't have to go somewhere else to do it.
That's right.
The common misconception is that's where the big markets are. That's where the big shots are. But, you know, if you are not looking to be in the big shot world and you just want to pursue your passion and share it with others and be with a very large group of people who are just so thrilled to have you, it's a great place to be. So
it's nice to have a fan base and people that follow you and you can keep them abreast of what you're going to be doing and, you know, where you're going to be reading and performing and whatnot. So it's really a joy to be able to just make that difference, you know, in the community.
I love it. I love to hear it. The last thing I have for you is just where can people learn more about you, see what you're doing?
Okay. Well, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under Sandra Gill. And you can find me also on Linktree under Sandra Rivers Gill.
Beautiful. Well, I hope people will check you out, and I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks
Appreciate
for being
it.
Here today.
Thank you.
This has been today's episode of Proud to Be of Rust and Glass. Toledo is so lucky to have artists like Sandra Rivers Gill People who show us that if you have passion for something, pursue it. Don't let anyone put your art in a box. Creativity is always going to be a transformative process. And if you aren't the person you'd like to be today, making great art can change that, sometimes without you even realizing it. Again, I am your host and producer, Curtis Dieter. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you want to join the conversation, check us out at wgte.org/rustandglass. Until next time, thanks for listening. Now go forth and create.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.